From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After leaving Saturday Night Live, Julia Sweeney started writing and performing autobiographical monologues. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about her latest, Letting Go of God. It's about how she rededicated herself to the Catholic Church and ended up losing her faith. The monologue has just been released on CD. A New York Times review described it as searing and bracingly funny, lucid and, yes, inspirational. Also, writer Richard Ford talks about his new novel, The Lay of the Land. It concludes his trilogy of books about the character Frank Bascom. The middle book, Independence Day, won a Pulitzer Prize. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Julia Sweeney, first became known as a cast member on Saturday Night Live. Since leaving the show, she's consulted on Sex and the City and Desperate Housewives. She's also been creating autobiographical monologues. Her monologue, God Said Ha, told the story of how she was diagnosed with cancer as her brother was dying of cancer. She managed to make this story both funny and moving. She performed it in theaters and also made a movie of it. Her latest monologue is called Letting Go of God. It's about how she rededicated herself to the Catholic Church at the age of 38, but found the deeper she got, the more skeptical she became of the Bible and religion. She now considers herself an atheist. She concludes an off-Broadway run this weekend, but the monologue has just been released on CD with a booklet that includes the entire text. Let's start with an excerpt from Letting Go of God. Sweeney is describing her reactions to closely reading the Bible. She's found the Old Testament surprisingly disturbing and is looking forward to a close reading of the New Testament and meeting Jesus again as if it were for the first time. And again, what she finds surprises her.
Well, first of all, Jesus was much angrier than I expected him to be. I mean, I knew he got angry with all those money changers in the temple, but I really had no idea that he was so angry so much of the time. And very impatient. Jesus says that he speaks in parables because the people, they just don't understand anything else. But the parables are often foggy and meaningless, and Jesus is snippy when even the disciples don't get them. He says to them, if you don't understand this parable, then how can you understand any parable? And are you incapable of understanding? I kept thinking, don't teach in parables then. It's not working. Even your staff doesn't understand. Why don't you just say what you mean? And then there's family. I have to say that for me, the most deeply upsetting thing about Jesus is his family values, which is amazing when you think how there's so many groups out there who say they base their family values on the Bible. I mean, he seems to have no real close ties to his parents. He puts his mother off cruelly over and over again. At the wedding feast, he says to her, "Woman, what have I to do with you?" And once, while he was speaking to a crowd, Mary waited patiently off to the side to talk to him, and Jesus said to the disciples, "Send her away. You are my family now." Matthew, Mark, and Luke all tell this exact same story, but Mark actually tells us why Mary was there to see Jesus. He says Mary came to see Jesus to restrain him because the people were saying he's gone out of his mind. I kept thinking, yes, let's go get Jesus and get him some help.
An excerpt of Julia Sweeney's CD, Letting Go of God. Here's my interview with her. Before we get to how you lost your faith, let's get to how you had become more religious. And you describe in your monologue that at the age of 38, you had what I think some people would describe as a born-again experience, though you wouldn't have used those words. But could you describe that experience that you had?
I was raised Catholic, and I liked being Catholic, and I didn't think that Catholicism was the only way to be with God or anything, but I thought it was a good way to be with God, and I liked being Catholic. And then I went through this terrible breakup when I was 38, and I was in this 4-year relationship, and I completely expected to, you know, marry and raise children with this man. And then he abruptly, you know, called off the relationship, and I was just devastated because it wasn't just him. It was just my whole idea of how I thought my life was going to go. So I think I went into my first real depression of my life where I really let myself be depressed. I really was depressed. And I was crying all the time. Like, it was really just a huge catastrophe for me, this breakup. And this one night I woke up and I could hear myself mouthing these words, "Heal me." And I had been praying a lot too, but so that wasn't out of my mind. That wasn't out of nowhere. But I kind of woke myself up hearing myself saying that. And then I felt this light in the room, and I really sensed that God was in the room, and I had this great sense of connectedness with the universe. Like, it's hard to put it into words the experience I had, but it was just very profound religious experience. And I felt very close to God, and I suddenly felt like I knew things were going to turn out okay, and that this breakup was part of my divine destiny that God must have wanted for me to go through. And I felt healed. I did feel healed. It was a very positive experience. And then, that inspired me to kind of rededicate myself to the Catholic Church.
Yeah, well, as you say, you signed up for a Bible study class, and that turned into a real problem for you, as we heard in the first excerpt. The New Testament was very disillusioning to you, and the Old Testament was as well. You describe God's sadistic tests of loyalty in the Old Testament, and Jesus' confusing parables in the New Testament. Did you express your confusion or disillusionment to your Bible study teacher?
Yes. I had a priest who was teaching the class, and, you know, when I read, you know, those stories as a kid, like about the flood or about Abraham being asked to murder his son Isaac, I was a kid. And when I read it as an adult, it was just, I could not get around that story of Abraham and Isaac. And I know, you know, lots of people can't get around that story, and lots of religious people have written a lot about it. But I just, to me, it was so clearly this way of, like, forcing someone to be so submissive to a God that they would be willing to do the most heinous act anyone could imagine, which was kill their child, you know? And I expressed my doubts. I mean, like, I said to the priest about this particular story, like, if what matters to me most is my loving behavior or my ethics, then I guess this story is telling me that I should be willing to give up my own ethics for God if that's what's called upon. And then he just said, no, that's your ethics is your love and faith in God. You're not hearing the story right. And then he would take me aside and try to help me read the Bible in a different way. But I always felt like the ways he was trying to get me to read it were ways that got the Bible off the hook. Like he would say, you can't read the Bible unless you have faith already, or you have to read it with the eyes of faith. And God wants us to know this story. And maybe we got parts of it wrong, but this is the story God wants us to know. So he would try to get me to stop reading the Bible with critical eyes, basically.
Now, another question you raise about your faith, you know, has to do with Jesus. You ask yourself, if Jesus was put on earth by God to suffer for our sins and die, then what about your brother Mike? And your brother Mike is somebody that a lot of your fans know through an earlier monologue called God Said Ha, which is about how he slowly died of cancer. And during that period when he was dying, you were diagnosed with cervical cancer, which obviously, and thankfully, you survived. So what were you a practicing Catholic when you were sick and when your brother died? And did faith help you through his death and your illness?
Yes and no. I feel like at the time, we were attending church and we were using words like we pray for Mike, and we did have, you know, me and my family talked a lot, like after Mike died, like, you know, Mike's in a better place. We use those kinds of words, and we hope he's not suffering anymore, and we hope he's happy now. So we had this idea of an afterlife, and we used the ideas of religion to bring us together, you know, praying and so forth. And I think at the time, that seemed like it was helpful, but now I have such a different perspective looking back on it. I think it kept us from being in reality. I mean, there's no doubt that religion offers comfort, and it did offer us some comfort, but I can't say that I'm glad I had it. I actually wish I had already had my new perspective when Mike was sick, because now the way I look at people and their lives is so different. I think I would have appreciated the beautiful flower that he was at that moment, that was going to just die and never be again, in a different way than I did.
Can you talk a little bit more about how you see his death now compared to how you saw it when you were still practicing Catholic?
Well, I guess I thought everyone had this destiny that God set out for them. I had this idea that God, you know, dealt you a hand of cards, and those are the hand of cards that you were dealt, and God was watching to see how you responded to your particular problems and challenges in life. And Mike's was that he was going to get this cancer, and I felt God knew that he was going to die, that it was inevitable. You know, I believed in fate and destiny. And now I just think, oh, he got a terrible disease, this lymphoma, and he fought it valiantly for 9 months, and he suffered greatly, and then he died, and he's gone. And it was not inevitable, and it was not preordained by God, and it wasn't his divine destiny. It's simply what happened to him. And even though that sounds kind of cold and harsh, I actually find it to be beautiful and comforting, actually, my point of view now, because I just see us as humans in this world that are subject to random chance and to bad things happening, like people get cancer or whatever, they get hit by a bus. There's nothing preordained about it. It's just what happens. So I feel actually comforted in my new worldview compared to my old one.
My guest is Julia Sweeney. Her latest autobiographical monologue, Letting Go of God, has just been released on CD. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Julia Sweeney. Her latest autobiographical monologue, Letting Go of God, has just been released on CD. It's about rededicating herself to the Catholic Church, then losing her faith. You know, during the monologue, you almost describe deciding to leave the church as if you were, like, breaking up with Jesus. You know what I mean? As if you'd had this relationship, and you're deciding, I don't know, should we break up or not? Are we compatible? Is this working? Can you talk a little bit about how you actually weighed in your mind, like, is this working or not? You know, do I want to stay in the church or do I want to leave?
Well, that, you know, leaving the church was just step one, because then I still believed in God for a long time after I left the church. I sort of believed Jesus might have some sort of supernatural, you know, godlike quality to him too. But when I left the church, it was more like I was really angry at the Catholic Church when I left, because I felt like they were blatantly lying to their people. I thought it was so obvious that the Bible wasn't based on historical fact or even anything that you could show that was a sign from God or anything. And I felt like it was so obvious. And I felt angry at this priest because he wouldn't come clean to me. Like, he had a lot of wink, wink kind of answers for me. Like, you and I are the smart ones and we know that it's legends. Like, he even took me aside at one point and said, oh, these stories are just legends and they're just told around the campfire by sheiks making God impressive by their ancient standards. And I started feeling like there was this double standard, like for people like me who were sincerely and, you know, looking for answers, there was the wink, wink answer. And then for the sheep of the church, there was this other answer. And I felt like he was dismissive of me. And he was saying, you can have doubts, but you'll always come back. And I guess I don't think that's the whole Catholic Church. I actually really love the Catholic Church. I feel very connected to the Catholic Church. It's my culture. It's the rituals that mean something to me. But I didn't feel like I could be a member of that church. I couldn't say I was a Catholic. And I felt angry at the whole institution about it.
So you left the institution, but still tried to maintain some personal relationship with God?
Yeah, I guess I had sort of a, you know, modern view of, you know, Jesus and Buddha and, you know, Muhammad and Abraham, and they're all have, you know, these were people that God chose to inspire them to bring us messages about how to live, and through them, but not exclusively through one of them. You know, I had that kind of attitude about it.
How long did that work for you?
That was like a year and a half.
Was there a period where you actually kind of sat down and tried to, like, weigh the reasons to remain religious on some level and the reasons to just, like, give up totally? Was there, like, a process of making a decision, or did the decision just kind of happen?
Well, kind of both. I mean, from the Buddhism, I got into a bunch of New Age ideas because I wanted science. I did not have a background in science, but I wanted to feel that my religious faith was based on some rational and real content. I had a desire for that. So I gravitated towards, like, Deepak Chopra and his whole quantum consciousness theories. And really it was Deepak Chopra inadvertently who was my gateway to atheism, because he introduced science.
That wasn't his intention.
No. But he used scientific terms, and I didn't really know that much about science. But he was talking about quantum mechanics and things like that, and it was intriguing, and that's what he bases his philosophy on. And so I started looking into quantum mechanics, and then I took a class, and that was really the beginning of the end for me, because I discovered the scientific method. It wasn't even so much discovering science. So I started filtering all of my beliefs through this method that we have come up with to find what is the closest to truth. And things were not coming through that method very well.
So science gave you another way of looking at the world, and that moved you further away from religion.
Yeah. And then I kept thinking, oh, science, you know, I didn't really study much science. I didn't feel in my mind that science, you know, I went to an all-girls Catholic school, and, you know, I took biology and geometry, but people didn't really encourage us to be in the sciences. Of my girlfriends that I still have from that time, none of us are really in the sciences, except for a couple of people of them who become nurses. But it wasn't like, well, of course, they don't want to encourage you to have a rigorous scientific understanding of the world, because then you would turn it back on the church and the whole thing would be dismantled. But I just never had that background. I didn't know about science, really. You know, I believed in the theory of evolution, which now I know the way to say it is to say I accept the theory of evolution. That's the way a scientist would say it. But I just didn't really know that much about it. It was very exciting. It was like this whole big world. And so I just started reading and reading and reading about science, and I started being comfortable with these terms, and I started learning about quantum mechanics and quantum theory for real, not just the way that people like Deepak Chopra completely subvert them for their own interests. And then I didn't think about God anymore. I was just kind of in my whole zhuzh of I love science, this whole new thing. But eventually, after a long period of time, the voices inside my head saying there is no God, or there is probably no God, which is the way a scientist would say it, were just so overwhelming. I couldn't ignore it anymore.
So after you decided that you really don't believe and that you think there is no God, you say that you had shared your mind with a God your whole life, and now you realize that your thoughts were completely your own. No one was monitoring them. No one was compassionately listening to them. Your thoughts were your own private affair and something no one but you knew about. So was that a kind of lonely feeling if you'd previously always thought that God was listening in and paying attention to your every thought?
Yeah, because for me, you know, looking back on it, I think my God was sort of like a friendly uncle who lived in your head, and he was sort of surprised by the things that happened to you too. You know, I mean, even though I also thought he created this destiny for you, in functionality, he was just this sort of nice monk that was in this library of your head that came out and listened to your problems and told you everything was going to be okay. You know, I don't mean to trivialize it. I really relied on that monk. But it was terrifying to think that. I had always been coached and taught to think that, you know, if you're having troubles or things are bad, you prayed. And now I didn't have anyone to listen to my thoughts but myself. Like, it was very difficult. But then it was also liberating, because I didn't have a lot of guilt. My God thing didn't include a lot of guilt. My God was very compassionate towards me and my problems. But I also felt free, because that privacy that I suddenly had in my brain, that I could, you know, I really did have this thought, like, say I was talking to someone and I really didn't like them. I would think, I don't like that person. And then I would hear the God in me say, oh, you can't feel hatred towards someone. That is another beautiful human being. And then I would think, oh no, I don't hate that person. I would have that debate kind of. I mean, I had this vague idea, the sense of that. And all of a sudden I realized I could have internal thoughts that were completely my own and no one knew about them.
Yeah, but you're also saying here that there was always this voice in your head, which you attributed to God, saying, be a good person. And that's people's,
yes.
That's one of the fears about people who abandon religion, that there won't be that voice in their head saying, be a good person. And that their more base instincts will run free without that voice saying, no, think about this. Find the good side of each person.
Yes, I can see how people would think that. I thought that myself. But then the more I learned about the world and about human beings, the more I discounted it. Because, first of all, there's whole societies that are existing perfectly well right now that have huge populations of people who don't believe in God. You know, like Norway and Sweden and so forth. I mean, they function, their murder rates are less than ours. Like, you, there's like, you know, you can bring facts to say that there are societies of people who don't believe in God that don't have the problems that I think most people think might happen if a large part of the population didn't believe in God. And also, I feel, for me, I became a more moral person after I stopped believing in God, because I saw myself as a member of a community that had a certain responsibilities and wanted to be trustworthy, because that's in my advantage, and compassionate, because that's an advantage to me and to the people I love. And I saw myself differently. And I think that we evolved these ethics inside of us to make us, you know, see the good side of a person, or try to make things work out, or try to be in community with others, because we're social animals, and social animals have, and we're very complex social animals, and we have this network of things. And one of the things that we have inside of us that has evolved is these ethics and morals and compassion for each other. And once I saw myself that way, I thought it was actually creepy that we were trying to control people by creating this idea of a God, and then having the God admonish them in their minds for having wrong thoughts or not being compassionate. I think if we had, I mean, this will never happen, but in my mind, if we taught our children ethics, that you are part of a community, this is your responsibility as part of a community, these are other human beings, they have rights, these are what those rights are, I think we'd all be better off with that, with thinking about it that way.
Julia Sweeney's latest autobiographical monologue, Letting Go of God, has just been released on CD. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Bob and Mary Montgomery, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, writer Richard Ford on reviving Frank Bascom, the main character in his novels The Sports Writer and Independence Day, which won a Pulitzer Prize. Ford's new novel, The Lay of the Land, concludes the trilogy. And we talk more with Julia Sweeney. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Julia Sweeney. Since leaving Saturday Night Live, she's written and performed autobiographical monologues. Her latest, Letting Go of God, is about rededicating herself to the Catholic Church and then losing her faith. She concludes an off-Broadway run on Sunday. The monologue has just been released on CD with a booklet including the complete text. When you left the church, your parents were very angry, and they took it very personally, and your father even said to you, you've betrayed your family, your school, your city. I don't even think you should come to my funeral, he told you. And then he died, I guess, about a year ago?
2 years ago.
2 years ago.
Yeah.
And so I think you'd kind of reconciled before that, but Did you speak at his funeral, and did that statement that he made to you resonate in your mind when you spoke, and did you attempt at all to deal with the meaning of religion in his life and the lack of meaning religion now had in yours?
Yeah, well, you know, when my dad said that, it was really, my dad was the most wonderful person. I mean, and he was the most loving and accepting person. And I think, because my parents were all in this big tizzy because it was in the paper that I said I was an atheist. And this was just the worst. And they actually knew I didn't believe in God. But for me to be in the paper saying I was an atheist was just like the worst possible thing. And there was a big reaction to it. And we reconciled pretty quickly after that. I mean, it was just a few weeks after that that my dad and I were back on great terms. And he even called me and said, I'm proud of you for saying what you think. I'm sorry I said that. I was just reacting to the moment of this embarrassment. And then we had a long time after that that we were very close. And he became close to my daughter. And, you know, like we had that was a blip. But I will say that I began to appreciate his faith, especially as he got sicker and closer to death himself. And then even at his funeral, I felt like I could see the church through his eyes. In his life, the church was such a meaningful part, and he loved it so much, and the Mass offered him such solace, and he was a daily communicant. He went to Mass every day, and he was friends with the priests. Like, his world, you know, at Gonzaga University and in Spokane, this very close Catholic community, was very Catholic, and it made his life very rich. And I could see that through his eyes. And I'm glad for him that he had that.
When you look back on the experience that inspired you to rededicate yourself to the Catholic Church, that experience when you were 38, when you were very upset because your boyfriend had left you, and you felt this almost like visitation, this spiritual visitation. There was this like light and warmth and a comforting sense of well-being. Now that you no longer have faith in God, you interpreted that feeling as a spiritual, spiritual thing. So when you look back on it now, what do you make of it? What do you think it was?
I think it was just a firing of the right temporal lobe. Like, now I understand how, I understand much better how our brain works. And I understand how we can have these experiences. Some people, like with epilepsy, have these experiences all the time. It was like almost like a very slight epileptic seizure is basically how it works in the brain. And also I had been coached to have these experiences. Like, I loved reading about the saints. I read about religious experience a lot. So I can understand how my psychology would interpret this crisis in a way that might cause a triggering of that kind of experience to happen. So I look at it scientifically now. But it's true that if I'm in a crisis again, and I'm a human being, surely I'll be in crisis again. I probably won't have that to draw on. I don't probably have that. But I also have so much that is so much better. I have a rational way of looking at the world. I have a skeptical way of looking at the world, and I mean that in a very positive way. I protect myself. I see things rationally. My life is much better now because of that. So I don't know how much I would need that, although I'm sure I will go through crises where I'll be looking for anything to comfort me.
You adopted a daughter who's now 4 years old, 5 years old?
She's six.
6 years old. Okay, thank you. And when you were that age, I'm sure that there were a lot of like Catholic rituals in your life. And when you asked your parents about things pertaining to life and death, they could give you answers about God and Jesus and so on. And those are answers you cannot give your daughter right now. And there are certain rituals that you probably can't provide for her either. So is that a bit of a crisis for you? And are you finding things to take their place?
Well, it's two different things. Like, to me, when my daughter asks me like what happens after we die, I just say we decompose. Like, I'm just clear about it. And in fact, we even had this when she was asking, you know, like about 4, I guess kids get all obsessed about death, and she did too. And of course, at that time, my dad was dying, and we had a cat who died. There's a lot of death around. And there was this bird who had died in our driveway, and I just left it there. And every day we went and looked at this bird, you know, and saw what happened. And then, but then I taught her about how we think about people. People mean things to us. That's how they live on. Even though our body doesn't live on, you know, the people we love, we're influenced by them. We're different people for having known them. That's how those people live on. And she was okay with it. That wasn't a terrifying thought for her. And so for her, it doesn't seem very traumatic to not be able to give her those, you know, easy answers that the church gave me. On the other hand, we live in Los Angeles and we are not part of a religious community. I mean, we belong to this tennis club that's sort of like a big YMCA in our neighborhood, and we see people there, but there aren't rituals. I mean, it's not as good. I mean, I have to say, it's a loss for her. I wish I could give her the upbringing that I had with the parishes and the neighborhoods. I mean, to me, that was fantastic. And I wish we could go to church on Sundays. Like, I don't know if I've just been so deeply moved by the Catholic experience that they just don't seem to live up to my, you know, like, I don't know why I don't keep it up. Like, we just don't have that. And she doesn't have that. And I think, you know, I have this vague fantasy that I'm going to move back to Spokane when she's like in third or fourth grade. And then, you know, I can't say that I wouldn't necessarily put her back in a Catholic school where I went to school at St. Augustine's in Spokane. Like, to me, it is a loss. I haven't figured out exactly what the replacement is for her.
Julia Sweeney, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Julia Sweeney's latest autobiographical monologue, Letting Go of God, has just been released on CD with a booklet including the complete text. She concludes her off-Broadway performance of the monologue Sunday. Let's squeeze in some music here. Clarinetist, saxophonist, and composer Don Byron has a new CD of music written by Junior Walker. I recorded an interview with Byron that we'll hear sometime soon. Here's his version of Junior Walker's best-known recording. Dean Bowman sings on this track. Coming up, Richard Ford talks about his new novel in which the 55-year-old main character is living through what he describes as the permanent period of life. We'll find out what that means after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Richard Ford's new novel, The Lay of the Land, is his third book about his character Frank Bascom. Frank is a sports writer turned New Jersey real estate agent who first appeared in Ford's 1986 novel, The Sports Writer, and returned in the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Independence Day. By the time the new novel has started, Frank's 9-year-old son has died, his first marriage has collapsed, and his second wife has left him for her first husband. The new novel is set in 2000 in the days just before Thanksgiving, as Frank is preparing to host a family reunion. He's gotten treatment for prostate cancer, and his 25-year-old daughter has been helping him through it. Frank is 55 and living through the period of life that he describes as the permanent period, a period in which you should quit worrying about your own existence and get busy doing and being. Here's a short reading.
One of the pure benefits of the permanent period, when you're as nose down and invisible to yourself as an actualized, unchangeable non-becomer, as snugged into life as a planning board member, is that you realize you can't completely screw everything up anymore, since so much of your life is on the books already. You've survived it. Cancer itself doesn't really make you fear the future and what might happen. It actually makes you, at least it's made me, not as worried as you were before you had it. It might make you concerned about lousing up an individual day or wasting an afternoon like this one, but not your whole life.
That's Richard Ford reading from his new novel, The Lay of the Land. Richard Ford, how did you come up with this idea of the permanent period of someone's life?
Well, I was trying to make the novel, my novel, useful to its readers to identify periods of life which might otherwise be overlooked, sort of periods when you're sort of in the middle of things and can't see one end and can't see the other end, and something needs to be done about those periods to make them seem singular, to make them seem that you're living in an epoch of life which you as an individual can make good use of. So I made that up for them, just as I did in Independence Day for the existence period of life. So it's, again, something I think a novel can be useful for.
And what was the existence period of life that your character was in your previous novel about him?
I don't think I even remember.
I see it was very helpful to you.
I know you're supposed to remember all those things, but I'm not sure I remember. This novel's so full in my face these days. I'm just now getting out from under its spell on my life. But it was a period, the existence period was a period in the one's 40s when, again, you might be likely to be so nosed down and snugged into whatever you're doing that you don't notice what's around you. And for Frank, anyway, in Independence Day, it was not a particularly halcyon period of his life. And I was just trying to identify it for him, for Frank, and thereafter for readers, so that they could say, well, this period is not just a period to exist in, it's a period to live in.
The Lay of the Land is in part about mortality, and you've given your main character prostate cancer.
Yes.
In deciding what affliction you were going to give him, why did you give him prostate cancer?
I probably gave him prostate cancer because it's one of those ones that terrifies me. Every year, you know, you go in for your PSA exam, and my heart skips about 8,000 beats every time I do that. My mother died of metastatic breast cancer, and one of my relatives on the day of her funeral was kind enough to tell me that I was probably going to get prostate cancer because she had, I guess it's my cousin's way of helping me grieve, that I was probably going to get prostate cancer because my mother had that. And so that always completely nerved me up every time I went in to get my blood studies at the Mayo Clinic. And so it just seemed, you know, just the most natural thing to do. Well, why not give him that, since it's the thing that freaks me out so much? And then I also afterwards did a lot of research about it and found that it had all kinds of language associated with it, which I was happy to put in play in a book. I mean, a lot of things that go into novels because the writer gets access to language which she or he wants to put in play in a book and see if that language can be made interesting in a new context.
To write this book, you had to think a lot about mortality. And is that a subject you're preoccupied with when you're not writing?
Well, it must be true. I hate for it to be true, since there's so many more interesting things to think about than that. But it probably is true. I was to bring in lumbering old biography, I was the kid of older parents and the grandchild of much older grandparents. And my family members started kicking off at about age 4 or 5 and went right along kicking off till that whole pair of generations was gone, basically. So I think I grew up in Mississippi and Arkansas with a very vivid sense of people passing on. And when I was 20 and I had just joined the Marine Corps, I got hepatitis, and I had never been sick before, and I was in the hospital for a long time. And one day the doctor came in my room and he said to me, "Well, Richard," he said, "I don't think you're going to die now." And I thought, die? When did die get to be in this conversation? And thereafter, I became very hyper aware of my health and all of those kinds of matters that have to do with mortality. And so there we are, bing, bang, bong, 40 years later, I'm writing novels about it.
So when you were young and your older relatives were dying, what were the first things that you were told about death and what happens to somebody you know and love when they die?
Well, we were talking about the 1940s now, and both of my parents, who were wonderful parents, I should say, were not educated people, so we didn't have an ongoing death and grieving seminar in my life. People said, "Oh, Aunt Lizzie, she died," and that was kind of it. And then we got in the car and drove up to Northwest Arkansas, and there indeed was Aunt Lizzie dead, and that was pretty much the end of the seminar. And we weren't much churchy people, so that there wasn't a lot of talk about the afterlife or where people went. It was pretty much presented as a fact that happened, and we could all get kind of used to it, which I did. So that was kind of the end of it.
My guest is Richard Ford. His new novel is called The Lay of the Land. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Richard Ford. His new novel, The Lay of the Land, is his third book about the character Frank Bascom, a sports writer turned real estate agent who's now 55 and recovering from prostate cancer. So, you know, we've been talking about your new novel, which is the close, you say, of a trilogy. Are you certain that you'd never write about this character again?
Well, I'm not as certain about it as I am of some things that I'm certain about. But I don't have any urge necessarily to work that hard again. it was a challenge to bring this novel to its completion. And I thought to myself during the past year when Christina and I were working on this book, I was reading it aloud to her, I thought to myself, I hope the finishment of this book allows me to do something different. And by that, I don't mean, you know, to go to medical school, but to just maybe write something different that wasn't quite as onerous as that was being at the time. And I'm not complaining, because if you are a novelist, you have no reason or right to complain, because you choose to do this. No one makes or asks you even to do it. But on the other hand, it has its stresses, and I thought that's maybe about enough for me. I also don't know, Christina said for me never to say this, but I'll say it anyway. I don't know if writing about Frank in his 60s would interest me that much. Not to say that people alive in their 60s don't live vibrant, useful lives. I just don't have any clue about what I would say about it. And I think it's some level of urging as a novelist or as a poet or as an essayist. You have to be able to think, I think I can dream up something interesting and useful about this subject, and I don't know about that if I could.
You mentioned that before you publish, you read what you've written out loud to your wife. Why not give her the printed pages? Why do you read it out loud?
Well, I mean, she does have the printed pages. She's looking at a printed page, and I'm looking at a printed page, and we're sitting across a room from each other, and I'm reading it out loud. It's really an effort to bring her intelligence to bear, which is a good intelligence, and it's also an attempt for me to authorize every squiggle, every jot, every word choice, every paragraph break. I think that for me, since I'm dyslexic, is about the best way that I can do that. That to read things aloud and to hear everything, although there are some liabilities inherent in reading things aloud, but it's from the standpoint of authorizing everything, being sure that I am responsible for every single movement in the book, that's the best way for me to do it. Although it takes months to do that, you can imagine.
Is this because, like, if you just reread it, you can just kind of glide quickly over the parts that you don't really like or that need work? Just, like, pretend it didn't happen, whereas if you're reading it out loud, you have to speak every word and any of the problems become more apparent?
Well, the second part of that is certainly true. I mean, I'm too much of a Protestant ethic guy to ever glide over anything that I've written. I just really slog through it. What I do, though, and I'm sorry Christina isn't here to verify this, I can read something to myself and get it quite wrong, which is to say that the words on the page are not the words that register in my brain when I read it, and I'll start revising something that doesn't need to be revised because I will have read it wrong. So that when I read something out loud, I at least have her there to say, now, look, sweetheart, it says blue lights here, but you read yellow lights. And so just as a sort of a verifier of what I have on the page and what I want to have on the page, it's very useful for me to read it out loud. It's just part, as I say, of being dyslexic. I mean, and moreover, she says, you know, that as I'm reading something, that I will just start revising it from what's on the page through my brain and out my mouth, so that as I'm reading something along, I'm revising it and saying something that's not there. And what she will say to me quite patiently is, now, you may like this new way better, and you may not even have known that you were revising it in this way, but you were, and is this the way you want it? It's always slightly distressing to have that happen, but nonetheless it happens.
Does having dyslexia interfere with the pleasure of reading and with the work of writing?
Absolutely not. And it should be said that I'm not severely dyslexic. I am mildly dyslexic. I think from the time I was a kid and slow to learn to read in the first and second grades and third grades, that I had to learn to read very slowly, much more slowly than was true for my classmates in Mississippi in the 40s, 50s rather. And that one of the things I fell heir to were all of those, so to say, poetical aspects of language, the non-specifically cognitive aspects in which language is just a vehicle for communication, so that I became quite aware in my mouth and in my ear of language's sonorities and its syncopations and rhythms and pauses and meter and all of those things about prose, indeed. And that, in fact, that enhanced my appreciation of language and enhanced my appreciation of written literature. So that, no, it was not at all, other than to slow me down considerably, it was not at all a detriment in causing me to appreciate reading or to be inclined to write. I mean, it was me making, instinctually a virtue out of a vice, but goodness gracious, there was a virtue there.
Richard Ford, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Richard Ford's new novel is called The Lay of the Land. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Minhivar. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think, by food psychologist Brian Wansink. From Patricia Papper for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Running with Scissors, Augustine Burroughs' memoir about his weird and sometimes nightmarish upbringing, has been adapted into a film. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from Burroughs and from actress Annette Bening, who plays his mother. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.